The Illegal Trial of Jesus. This chapter is based on Matthew 26, verse 57 to 75. 27:1. Mark 14, verse 53 to 72. 15:1. Luke 22, verse 54 to 71. John 18, verse 13 to 27. Through the hushed streets of the sleeping city, they hurried Jesus. It was past midnight. Bound and closely guarded, the Savior moved painfully to the palace of Annas, the ex-high priest. Annas was the head of the officiating priestly family, and in deference to his age, the people recognized him as high priest. The leaders regarded his counsel as the voice of God. He must be present at the examination of the prisoner, for fear that the less experienced Caiaphas might fail to secure the result for which they were working. They must use Annas's cunning and subtlety, for they had to obtain Christ's condemnation. Christ was to be tried formally before the Sanhedrin, but before Annas in a preliminary trial. Under Roman rule, the Sanhedrin could only examine a prisoner and pass judgment to be ratified by the Roman authorities. It was therefore necessary to bring charges against Christ that both the Romans and also the Jews would regard as criminal. Christ's teaching had brought conviction to more than a few priests and rulers. Joseph of Arimathea and Nicodemus were not called to this trial, but others might dare to speak in favor of justice. The trial must unite the Sanhedrin against Christ. The priests wanted to establish two charges. If they could prove that Jesus was a blasphemer, the Jews would condemn him. If they could convict him of undermining Rome's rule, it would secure his condemnation by the Romans. The second charge was what Annas tried to establish first. He questioned Jesus, hoping the prisoner would say something to prove that he was seeking to establish a secret society with the purpose of setting up a new kingdom. Then the priests could deliver him to the Romans as a creator of revolt. As if reading the inmost soul of his questioner, Christ denied that he gathered his followers secretly and in the darkness to conceal his plans. "I spoke openly to the world," he answered. "I always taught in synagogues and in the temple, where the Jews always meet, and in secret I have said nothing." The Savior contrasted his manner of work with the methods of his accusers. They had hunted him to bring him before a secret tribunal, where they might use perjury to obtain what it was impossible to gain by fair means. The midnight arrest by a mob, the mockery and abuse before he was even accused, this was their manner of work, not his. Their action was in violation of the law. Their own rules declared that everyone should be treated as innocent until proved guilty. Turning upon his questioner, Jesus said, "Why do you ask me? Had not spies been present at every gathering of the people and carried information to the priests about all his sayings and doings? Ask those who have heard me what I said to them. Indeed, they know what I said." Annas was silenced. One of his officers, filled with anger, struck Jesus on the face, saying, "Do you answer the high priest like that?" Christ calmly replied, "If I have spoken evil, bear witness of the evil. But if well, why do you strike me?" His calm answer came from a heart sinless, patient, and gentle that would not be provoked. Christ received every indignity from the hands of the beings for whom he was making an infinite sacrifice. And he suffered in proportion to his holiness and hatred of sin. His trial by men who acted as demons was a perpetual sacrifice for him. To be surrounded by human beings under the control of Satan was revolting. And he knew that by flashing out his divine power, he could lay his cruel tormentors in the dust. This made the trial harder to bear. The Jews expected a Messiah to change the current of people's thoughts by one flash of overmastering will and force them to acknowledge his supremacy. So when Christ was treated with contempt, a strong temptation came to him to show his divine character, to make his persecutors confess that he was Lord above kings and rulers, priests and temple. It was difficult to keep the position he had chosen as one with humanity. Angels would gladly have delivered Christ. The angels of heaven longed to deliver Christ. Watching the shameful scene, how easily could they have consumed the adversaries of God? But God commanded them not to. It was part of Jesus' mission to bear in his humanity all the abuse that human beings could heap on him. Christ had said nothing that could give his accusers an advantage. Yet he was bound to signify that he was condemned. There must, however, be the form of a legal trial. This the authorities were determined to accomplish quickly. They knew the high regard the people had for Jesus, and they feared a rescue attempt. Again, if the execution did not happen right away, there would be a week's delay because of the Passover. This might defeat their plans. During a week's delay, a reaction would likely set in. The better part of the people would come forward with testimony to vindicate him, bringing to light the mighty works he had done. The Sanhedrin's proceedings would be condemned, and Jesus would be set free. So the priests and rulers determined that before their intentions could become known, Jesus must be delivered into the hands of the Romans. But first, they had to find an accusation. They had gained nothing so far. Annas ordered Jesus to be taken to Caiaphas. Though lacking in force of character, Caiaphas was fully as heartless and as willing to use any means necessary as was Annas. It was now early morning and dark. By torches and lanterns, the armed band with their prisoner proceeded to the high priest's palace. While the Sanhedrin were coming together, Annas and Caiaphas again questioned Jesus, but without success. In the judgment hall, Caiaphas took his seat as presiding officer. On either side were the judges and those specially interested in the trial. Roman soldiers were on the platform below the throne. At the foot of the throne stood Jesus. The excitement was intense. Of all the crowd, he alone was calm and serene. Caiaphas had thought of Jesus as his rival. The people were eager to hear the Savior, and this prompted the bitter jealousy of the high priest. But now, as Caiaphas looked at the prisoner, he was struck with admiration for his noble, dignified bearing. A conviction came over him that this man was like God. The next instant he banished the thought, and in haughty tones demanded that Jesus work one of his mighty miracles. But the Savior acted as though he had not even heard the words. The question arose in the minds of that hardened crowd. Should this man of godlike presence be condemned as a criminal? The enemies of Jesus were perplexed. They did not know how to bring about his condemnation. Caiaphas wanted to avoid stirring up conflict. There were plenty of witnesses to prove that Christ had called the priests and scribes hypocrites and murderers, but this was not useful to bring out. Such testimony would have no weight with the Romans. There was much evidence that Jesus had spoken irreverently of many of the Jews' regulations. This evidence also would have no weight with the Romans. Christ's enemies did not dare to accuse him of Sabbath breaking, since an examination would bring to light his miracles of healing. The leaders had bribed false witnesses to accuse Jesus of trying to establish a separate government. But their testimony turned out to be vague and contradictory. Under examination, they falsified their own statements. Early in his ministry, Christ had said, destroy this temple, and in 3 days I will raise it up. In this way, he had foretold his own death and resurrection. He was speaking of the temple of his body. John 2, verse 19-21. Of all that Christ had said, the priests could find nothing to use against him except this. The Romans had engaged in rebuilding and beautifying the temple, and they took great pride in it. If anyone showed contempt for it, they would be offended. Here, Romans and Jews had common ground, for all regarded the temple with great respect. One witness who had been bribed to accuse Jesus declared, "This fellow said, 'I am able to destroy the temple of God and to build it in 3 days.'" If the witness had reported Christ's words exactly as he spoke them, they would not have brought about his condemnation even by the Sanhedrin. His declaration would only have indicated an unreasonable, boastful spirit, but not blasphemy. Even as the false witnesses misrepresented his words, they contained nothing the Romans regarded as a crime worthy of death. At last, Jesus' accusers were entangled, confused, and angry. It seemed that their plottings were going to fail. Caiaphas was desperate. He had only one last resort: to force Christ to condemn himself. The high priest stood up suddenly from the judgment seat, his face contorted with passion. "Do you answer nothing?" he exclaimed. "What is it these men testify against you?" Jesus remained silent. He was oppressed and he was afflicted, yet he opened not his mouth. He was led as a lamb to the slaughter, and as a sheep before its shearers is silent, so he opened not his mouth. Isaiah 53, verse 7. Finally, Caiaphas addressed Jesus in the form of a solemn oath. "I put you under oath by the living God. Tell us if you are the Christ, the Son of God." To this appeal, Christ could not remain silent. He knew that to answer now would make his death certain. But the appeal came from the highest acknowledged authority of the nation and in the name of the Most High. He must plainly declare his character and mission. Jesus had said to his disciples, "Whoever confesses me before men, him I will also confess before my Father who is in heaven." Matthew 10, verse 32. Now by his own example, he repeated the lesson. Every eye was focused on Jesus' face as he answered, "It is as you said." A heavenly light seemed to illuminate his pale features as he added, "Nevertheless, I say to you, hereafter you will see the Son of Man sitting at the right hand of the power and coming on the clouds of heaven." For a moment, the high priest trembled before the penetrating eyes of the Savior. Never from then on did he forget that searching glance of the persecuted Son of God. Caiaphas, almost convinced. The thought that all would stand at the judgment bar of God, to be rewarded according to their works, terrified Caiaphas. The scenes of the final judgment rushed into his mind. For a moment, he saw the graves giving up their dead, with the secrets he had hoped were forever hidden. He felt as if the eternal judge was reading his heart, bringing to view mysteries supposed to be hidden with the dead. Caiaphas had denied the resurrection, the judgment, and a future life. Now a satanic fury maddened him. Tearing his robe, he demanded that the council condemn the prisoner for blasphemy. "What further need do we have of witnesses?" he said. "Look, now you have heard his blasphemy. What do you think?" And they all condemned him. Caiaphas was furious with himself for believing Christ's words, and instead of having his heart broken and confessing that Jesus was the Messiah, he tore his priestly robes in determined resistance. This act was deeply significant. He did it to secure Christ's condemnation, but in doing so, the high priest had condemned himself. By the law of God, he was disqualified for the priesthood. He had pronounced on himself the death sentence. A high priest was not to tear his garments. By the Levitical law, under no circumstances was the priest to tear his robe. Christ had expressly commanded Moses concerning this. See Leviticus 10, verse 6. Finite man might rend his own heart by showing a contrite and humble spirit. But no one must tear the priestly robes, for this would mar the representation of heavenly things. The high priest who dared to engage in the service of the sanctuary with a torn robe was considered to have cut himself off from God. Caiaphas's action showed human passion, human imperfection. By tearing his garments, Caiaphas made the law of God of no effect and followed human traditions. A man-made law provided that, in case of blasphemy, a priest might tear his garments in horror at the sin and not be guilty. In this way, the law of God was set aside by human laws. But in this act, Caiaphas himself was committing blasphemy. When Caiaphas tore his garment, his act signified the place the Jewish nation would occupy toward God after this. The Jewish people had rejected him who was the fulfillment of all their symbols, the substance of all their shadows. Israel was divorced from God. Well might the high priest tear his robes in horror for himself and for the nation. The injustice of Christ's trial. The Sanhedrin had pronounced Jesus worthy of death, but it was contrary to Jewish law to try a prisoner by night. In legal condemnation, nothing could be done except in the light of day and in a full session of the council. Despite this, the Savior was now treated as a condemned criminal, to be abused by the lowest of humankind. Through the open courtyard, Jesus was taken to the guardroom, surrounded by people mocking his claim to be the Son of God. They jeeringly repeated his words, "Coming on the clouds of heaven." While in the guardroom awaiting his legal trial, Jesus was not protected, and the ignorant rabble took the opportunity to reveal all the satanic elements of their nature. Christ's godlike bearing filled them with an insane rage. Mercy and justice were trampled upon. Never was a criminal treated in so inhuman a manner as was the Son of God. But no enemy's hand could have dealt the blow that gave Jesus the deepest pain. While he was undergoing the examination before Caiaphas, one of Christ's own disciples had denied him. Peter and John had dared to follow, at a distance, the mob that had Jesus in their custody. The priests recognized John and let him into the hall, hoping that as he witnessed his leader's humiliation, he would scorn the idea that such a one could be the Son of God. John spoke in favor of Peter and gained an entrance for him also. In the courtyard, a fire had been kindled, for it was cold, being just before dawn. People gathered around the fire, and Peter presumptuously joined them. By mingling with the crowd, he hoped to be taken for one of those who had brought Jesus to the judgment hall. Peter fails. But the woman doorkeeper looked carefully at him. She noticed the dejection on his face and thought he might be a disciple of Jesus. Curious to know, she asked, "You are not also one of his disciples, are you?" Peter was startled and confused. He pretended not to understand, but she persisted. Peter felt compelled to answer, and he said angrily, "Woman, I do not know him." This was the first denial, and immediately the rooster crowed. In pretending to have no involvement with Jesus, Peter had become an easy prey to temptation. Someone else called attention to him the second time, claiming he was a follower of Jesus. Peter now declared with an oath, "I do not know the man." Another hour passed, when a close relative of the man whose ear Peter had cut off asked him, "Did I not see you in the garden with him? Surely you are one of them, for you are a Galilean." At this, Peter flew into a rage. In order fully to deceive his questioners and justify his pretended identity, Peter now denied his master with cursing and swearing. Again the rooster crowed. Peter heard it and remembered the words of Jesus, "Before the rooster crows twice, you will deny me three times." Mark 14, verse 30. While the degrading oaths were fresh on Peter's lips and the shrill crowing of the rooster was ringing in his ears, the Savior turned and looked directly at his poor disciple. At the same time, Peter's eyes were drawn to his master. In that gentle expression, he read deep pity and sorrow, but no anger. The sight of that suffering face, those quivering lips, pierced his heart like an arrow. Peter remembered his promise of a few short hours before, when the Savior told him he would deny his Lord three times that very night. Peter now realized how accurately his Lord had read his the falseness of heart, which he had not known himself. A tide of memories rushed over him. The Savior's long suffering, his patience, he remembered it all. He reflected with horror on his own falsehood, his perjury. Once more he saw an ungodly hand raised to strike his master in the face. Unable to endure the scene any longer, he rushed, heartbroken, from the hall. He hurried on in solitude and darkness, not knowing or caring where. At last he found himself in Gethsemane. He remembered with bitter remorse that Jesus had agonized in prayer alone. He remembered his solemn instruction, "Watch and pray, lest you enter into temptation." Matthew 26, verse 41. It was torture to his bleeding heart to know that he had added the heaviest burden to the Savior's humiliation and grief. Peter fell on his face and wished that he would die. If he had spent those hours in the garden in watching and prayer, Peter would not have been left to depend on his own feeble strength. He would not have denied his Lord. If the disciples had watched with Christ in his agony, they would have been prepared to witness his suffering on the cross. Amid the gloom of the most trying hour, hope would have lighted up the darkness and sustained their faith. Determined efforts to condemn Jesus. As soon as it was day, the Sanhedrin assembled again, and once more Jesus was brought into the council room. He had declared himself to be the Son of God, but they could not condemn him on this, for many had not been there at the night session and had not heard his words. And they knew that the Roman official would find nothing worthy of death in those words. But if they could all hear from his own lips his claim to be the Messiah, they might twist this into a treasonous political claim. "If you are the Christ," they said, "tell us." But Christ remained silent. They continued to press him with questions. At last he answered, "If I tell you, you will by no means believe. And if I also ask you, you will by no means answer me or let me go." But he added the solemn warning, "Hereafter the Son of Man will sit on the right hand of the power of God." "Are you then the Son of God?" they asked. He said to them, "You rightly say that I am." They cried out, "What further testimony do we need? For we have heard it ourselves from his own mouth." And Jesus was to die. All that was necessary now was for the Romans to ratify this condemnation.
Then came the third scene of abuse, worse even than what the ignorant rabble had done. It took place in the very presence of the priests and rulers, with their approval. When the judges pronounced Jesus' condemnation, a satanic fury took possession of the people. The crowd made a rush toward Jesus. If it had not been for the Roman soldiers, he would not have lived to be nailed to the cross of Calvary. He would have been torn in pieces. Roman authority intervened and restrained the violence of the mob by force of arms. Heathen men were angry at the brutal treatment of one against whom nothing had been proved. The Roman officers declared that it was against Jewish law to condemn a man to death on his own testimony. This brought a momentary lull in the proceedings, but the Jewish leaders were dead both to pity and to shame. Priests and rulers forgot the dignity of their office and abused the Son of God with foul names. They taunted him about his parentage. They declared that his proclaiming himself the Messiah made him deserving of the most shameful death. Someone threw an old garment over his head, and his persecutors struck him in the face, saying, "Prophesy to us, Christ! Who is the one who struck you?" One poor wretch spat in his face. Angels faithfully recorded every insulting look, word, and act against their beloved commander. One day, the evil men who scorned the calm, pale face of Christ will look upon it in its glory, shining brighter than the sun.